Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
After 26 years of marriage, Bonnie Lee Schultz was ready to spread her wings. After being a stay-at-home mom to her two children, Josh and Gretchen, she was working part-time and had just started a second job. She was meeting new people and finding new opportunities. In 1997, Bonnie decided that a more drastic life change was in order. She wanted a divorce. Bonnie's husband, Rick Schultz, didn't want to end the marriage, and on July 3, 1997, Bonnie went out with some friends to clear her head. The Indianapolis, Indiana mom was never seen again. At first, Bonnie was thought to have left willingly or had befallen an accident, but when no signs of the 45-year-old or her car were found, police began to suspect foul play. Suspicion immediately went to her husband, but could a different man hold the answers to what happened to Bonnie Schultz that night? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Bonnie Schultz. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode. He's here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Now, as we record this, we are quickly approaching the 27th anniversary of Bonnie Schultz's disappearance. But despite a lack of national attention, this is far from a cold case. In fact, searches have been performed in the past couple of years, and I even found statements from her family on Facebook from just a few weeks ago. And so this is really one of those cases where I wouldn't be surprised if we wake up to a news headline about her being found. But even if she isn't, I want to get Bonnie's story out there. This was actually suggested by one of our listeners who sent it into our Facebook. So thank you for doing that. And it just proves that Bonnie was loved and is still missed by so many people. Before we get started, though, we have a few folks join us over on Patreon recently. So we want to give them a shout out. Thank you so much to Sarah D., Patricia S., Liz, Georgina R., and Lauren L. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you guys so, so much.
And if you'd like to join us on any level over at Patreon, you can receive ad-free episodes and a copy of the ebook that I wrote. All right, not a whole lot of business, but now that we've gotten it out of the way, let's get into the case of Bonnie Schultz. Bonnie Schultz was born on July 25th, 1951 in Wisconsin. She was one of five children and had three sisters and one brother. By the time all of this was happening in 1997, her mother had passed away and her father was in a nursing home. Bonnie met Rick Schultz when they were both in high school at Sheboygan South High School, which I cannot hear.
The Home Alone reference?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we're really big in Sheboygan. I'm sorry to all Sheboyganites who are probably sick of hearing that since 1989. The high school sweethearts married in 1970, shortly after they graduated high school. Rick joined the Navy, and the couple moved around for several years before finally settling in Indianapolis, Indiana, where Rick got a job at National City Bank. As a couple, Bonnie and Rick played euchre with friends every Friday night, which I feel
like that's a really old person thing to do.
No, that is what people of their age in the Midwest did with their weekends, because my parents are from Michigan and Ohio. And I remember when I was a kid growing up around the same time, because Bonnie and Rick are around my parents' age. And I remember them playing euchre like constantly.
Really?
Yeah. Like all in the 80s and like into the 90s.
Yeah. Pennsylvania parents had a way different idea of fun on a Saturday night.
Yeah, I don't know. But I never learned how to play myself. Like, I still to this day have no idea how to play that game. But my older brother and sister know how to play because they grew up in Michigan. And, you know, they're basically boomers. They don't listen to this show. So after being married for about 10 years or so, Bonnie and Rick started their family. Josh came first and was followed by Gretchen about 5 years later. Bonnie was a stay-at-home mom and was absolutely devoted to her children. She volunteered for the PTA and made sure to attend all of Josh's baseball games. She would take Gretchen on shopping trips, and the mother-daughter duo had plans to go see a movie together on July 4th. As the years went by and their family grew, they even had a dog, Bonnie and Rick seemingly began to grow apart. Once Gretchen started school, Bonnie got a part-time job at RGIS Inventory Specialists in nearby Carmel, Indiana. She had also recently taken on a second job at the Pike Township Trustee's Office. Bonnie was always well-liked and quick to make friends, whether it was through volunteering at the PTA or through her church. When she started her job, Bonnie quickly made friends there as well. Everything was great for several years. Friends said that the Schultz family reminded them of Leave It to Beaver. They had basically the perfect suburban life. But eventually, Bonnie decided she wanted a change. We know now that leading up to her disappearance, Bonnie had been talking to Rick about divorcing. According to a post made on Web Sleuths from a woman claiming to have worked with Bonnie, the Indiana mom had been unhappy in her marriage for quite a while. Now, I do want to put the caveat on this post with the fact that Web Sleuths actually does have a verification process for people who claim to be insiders, quote unquote, or like know people involved in these stories. She only posted this one post, so like didn't go through the verification process. So, you know, I don't 100% know that this is true, but she's not saying anything crazy. She's basically just saying that she worked with Bonnie, she knew her, she liked her, but she had left the job about 9 months prior to Bonnie's disappearance and hadn't seen her since then. But she says that Bonnie's unhappiness in her marriage was already, even back then, a frequent topic of conversation. So even at the very least, 9 months prior, like, Bonnie's coworkers knew that there was trouble in the marriage.
And so far as you know, the trouble aspect of the marriage wasn't like physical abuse or anything like that.
No. I've never heard anybody say anything along those lines. And in fact, Rick gave his perspective on their marital difficulties to Eyewitness News reporter Scott Swan, saying, quote, "She made comments that her and I don't have anything in common, and she liked doing one thing and I liked doing another. Most couples, in my opinion, are that way. What they have in common is the family," end quote. And like, you get it, right? Like that one short, brief statement really made everything pretty clear to me in terms of what she was probably going through at that time in her life.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the marriage has kind of fizzled out at that point.
Yeah, I mean, listen, these people were high school sweethearts.
Right.
They'd been married for 26 years. They were together, you know, I'm guessing for a couple of years before that.
Yeah, and people change, especially in that long of an age gap. Like,
yeah,
interests change, the way you interact with people change, like your whole personality grows and changes over that period of time.
Yeah, they literally went from being children together to being adults. And, you know, a lot happens in that 30-year period, basically. And so, you know, it's one thing. I'm not saying that, like, you could never grow and change together.
Right, but it takes work.
Right, and you both have to be on the same page. And right. It really doesn't seem as though they were, because it sounds like Rick was like, listen, you know, we had our family, we were doing our thing, everything was cool, this is what it's supposed to be. And Bonnie was like, well, I don't know, maybe there's more. So I can see how Bonnie might have been feeling frustrated and unseen in her relationship. And this frustration eventually led to betrayal as Bonnie began having an affair with one of her coworkers.
Did you know that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age?
That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. Hey everyone, it's Kona, host of And Then They Were Gone, and I am coming to you today to talk about True Diagnostic. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent straight to your door. True Age is actually sending me a test, and I'm really excited to see what it's going to say about my health. And frankly, a little frightened. Because even though I'm afraid it's going to tell me that my biological age is higher than my normal age, it's definitely information that I can use. Because by tracking my biological age, I can actually see how changes that I make, whether exercise, diet, or sleep, can affect my health over time. And this isn't guesswork. The True Age test is based on peer-reviewed research from scientists working with Harvard, Duke, and Yale. I don't know. I like to know everything, so I think it's going to be really cool to know exactly how my lifestyle is impacting my body. I already know there's definitely room for improvement, and I think this is going to give me some actionable steps. So if you're ready to join me and find out your biological age, right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code ATTWG at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, truediagnostic.com. Just use the code ATTWG to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today. On Thursday, July 3rd, 1997, Bonnie and Rick had a conversation. She told Rick she wanted a divorce. Rick wanted to go to marriage counseling instead. But what I don't know is whether or not Rick knew about Bonnie's affair. This would, of course, be a key piece of evidence, but I haven't found the answer in any of the source material. And I will say that there is really very little public information on this case. Not only did this not make national news, it barely made local news. I found, you know, 3 to 4 articles from, you know, the first year of her disappearance, and then a couple of articles 10 to 12 years later. And that's honestly about it.
So my question to that would be, if you're unsure whether Rick knew about the affair at that point, how did that come out? Like,
oh, well, so interestingly, it came out in the course of the investigation, and I'll get into the details of that. But it definitely 100% did not come from Rick, because initially when Rick reports his wife missing, you know, and the police are asking their questions, he's like, what? No, she's my wife. We're in love. Our marriage is fine. Don't worry about it. So Bonnie was upset, obviously, when she left the house. So that night she said that she was going to a party at a coworker's house. Some sources have described it as a birthday party. Others just called it, you know, a get together. So she left, and Josh, who was 15 at the time, went to stay the night at a friend's house, and 10-year-old Gretchen stayed home with Rick. At the party, Bonnie met up with her good friend and coworker, Anita Cardone. According to a post on Discovery.com, Bonnie was upset and crying when she arrived. She said that she and Rick had had a huge fight and that he wouldn't give her a divorce. She also allegedly said that she didn't know what he would do. And we don't have any more information on what she meant by that, but that is the only thing I've ever read that even remotely hints at like any fear she might have been feeling or any possible violence or anything like that.
Yeah, that statement doesn't really, you know, without further elaboration, it doesn't really indicate that she was worried about him being violent.
No, not at all. It could mean anything.
Yeah, I don't know what he would do
like
with his life.
Yeah.
What about the children?
Yeah. Would he try to take the kids? Like, right. Would he try to screw me out of money? Like, I mean, yeah, that could mean 100 billion different things.
Especially in the context of he wouldn't give me a divorce.
Right.
So you don't need to get permission from your spouse to get a divorce.
Right.
You can file it and it would be contested, of course, but like, to me, that statement seems as though she's like, we don't agree about getting divorced, so he's probably going to fight me on the divorce, and I don't know what he will do in that sense.
Right. I think that makes perfect sense, you know, and especially because he did say that himself. He's like, I didn't want to get divorced. I wanted to go to marriage counseling.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, like there was, it wasn't going to be a, hey, I want a divorce. Okay. Rick, when he talks about this later, denies that they had a fight. He calls it a discussion. Bonnie called it a huge fight. So, you know, different perspectives. So Bonnie and Anita stayed at the party for a little while, but then they decided to leave and get a couple of drinks over at a nearby bar called the Timeout Lounge. They went with at least one other coworker, the man with whom Bonnie was having the affair. So there may have been more people who went out with them, but the only two I know for sure are Anita and this guy. So when they arrived at the bar, Bonnie was apparently still pretty upset about her conversation slash argument with her husband. But as she talked with her friend and boyfriend, she seemed to calm down and enjoy herself. Bonnie apparently wasn't a big drinker, and even though they stayed out late that night, employees said that she didn't seem intoxicated when she left. They also said that she didn't seem distressed when she left. Early reports stated that the three left around 3 a.m., but some later reports have their departures closer to 4.
Well, the bar stays open pretty late then.
It does. And I was like, that seems insanely late for suburbia. Like, New York City bars stay open till 4. I didn't know Indianapolis was like that, because this isn't like the heart of the city. This is kind of a suburban area that they're in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I called our local Indianapolis native slash person who went out to a lot of bars in the 90s there. And he said, yeah, he said that last call's usually at 3 a.m. and that there's some Indiana term for it, but it was like whatever the term is for bars that only serve beer and wine. He said that they could stay open until at least 4 and they might not have to close it at all.
That sounds accurate for, from what I know about Indianapolis and the people from Indiana. Sorry to our fans who are from Indianapolis.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. So yeah, so them staying out till like 4 a.m. wasn't something that Bonnie necessarily did often,
but common.
It wasn't weird, you know. The three of them all got into separate cars because they all arrived at the party separately, drove to the bar separately, and then left separately. Anita says that she saw Bonnie get into her car alone and drive west on 62nd Street toward her home and Broad Ripple. Now, the bar was less than 10 miles from her house, but Bonnie never made it home that night. When Rick woke up the next morning, he of course noticed that his wife wasn't there. However, he just assumed that she had had too much to drink and decided to stay with a friend.
Yeah, and coming on the heels of the quote-unquote discussion slash huge fight, like,
yeah.
Yeah, I could definitely see, like, all right, well, she's clearly blowing off steam or whatever.
Right, yeah. And staying out, you know, with a friend, doesn't want to come home. Like, it makes sense. So, like, he didn't panic when he woke up that morning, you know?
Right. And this is also 1997, so we're talking cell phones did exist. There were not smartphones. And not a whole lot of people had cell phones.
Well, that actually does bring me to an unanswered question, because Bonnie had a cell phone. Okay. And the reason she had a cell phone is because she was very safety conscious. And it sounds like she might have worked kind of odd hours at her job, like maybe some, you know, evening shifts or night shifts or things like that. And it was in Carmel, which is nearby, but, you know, still a different town, right? So she apparently wanted to have a cell phone, like in case the car broke down or something like that, so she could call for help. Now, I do know that police checked her phone, of course, and it hadn't been used since the time she left the bar. But what I don't know, my huge unanswered question, is if Rick had tried to call her.
Mm.
And if he did, how many times?
Right.
And did he leave messages? You know, texting wasn't a big thing back then. Like, you could, but you had to pay extra for texts, so like nobody really did it.
Yeah, and the screens were terrible,
and you had to like press the button five times to get an S or whatever.
Right.
But like, yeah, so I don't have any information about incoming calls. Who was trying to get a hold of her that day when she wasn't showing up to home or work or anywhere else she was supposed to be. So, yeah, we get, though, why he wouldn't have woken up and been, you know, immediately concerned. But as the day went on and he didn't hear from her, she didn't come home, he did begin to worry. So around 5 p.m., he called the police and reported Bonnie missing. As you can imagine, the Marion County Sheriff's Department didn't exactly launch a full-scale search.
She's an adult.
She went out on her own, you know, she went out to, like, he didn't tell them about the fight or anything, but she still, like, went to a party, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
It was also the 4th of July when he's reporting her missing. So it's a holiday.
Right. Reduced staffing with the police or increased staffing because it's a holiday and they're responding to probably a whole lot of other drunken disorderly calls.
Yeah. I wonder if
illegal fireworks.
Yeah. I wonder if they do like extra staffing that earlier, if they wait till like do it at night on the 4th of July or, you know, whatever. Not that that matters.
No, because there also could have been a 4th of July parade. Yeah. You know, like we don't
know. True. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and this is a total off topic side note, but so many of the cases that we cover take place over a holiday weekend. And I wonder, like, it makes me wonder if, like, the reduced staffing or things like that contribute to the early days of these cases not necessarily getting the attention that they need, and if that, like, contributes to them ultimately not getting solved. So, like, just off the top of my head, and I didn't even look back at our episodes because we've done over 150 of these, but Johnny Gosch went missing, I believe it was Memorial Day. It could have been Labor Day. Kristen Smart went missing Memorial Day. Cindy Song went missing Halloween weekend. And I know we have another 4th of July, but it's escaping me right now. But it's a lot.
Is it the police response or do people just typically, you know, dip out of their lives over a holiday weekend because they figure like nobody's going to look for them?
I don't know. Well, Robert Hoagland didn't leave over a holiday weekend.
That's true.
And he's the only one we know for sure who dipped out on his life.
Very true.
Like we said, part of the reason why the sheriff's department wasn't like overly concerned is because she decided not to come home. That was their thought, even though they didn't even know about the marital problems or anything like that at this point. So that's the 4th that he reports her. Now, by the 5th, Rick had found out somehow. I don't know if he like was calling around to friends or if friends were calling his house or what was happening, but he had found out that Bonnie was last seen at the time out. So he took Josh and tried to retrace her steps.
Their 10-year-old son. 15.
The daughter's 10. Josh was 15.
Okay, got it backwards. Sorry.
Yeah. In an interview with the Noblesville Ledger a few weeks after Bonnie's disappearance, Rick said, quote, "We drove through every little parking lot from Allisonville to Broad Ripple. She actually vanished without a clue," end quote. So Allisonville, like Allisonville Road is where the bar, it's like the intersection of Allisonville and 62nd, I think is where the bar was. Broad Ripple is right past their house, but you know, in the direction that she would have been traveling. Interestingly, her boyfriend apparently lived in Broad Ripple. So I don't know if he was going all the way to Broad Ripple because he already knew that, or if he was just kind of covering all of his bases, you know, like going to the house and a little bit past the house.
Mm-hmm.
Rick called Bonnie's siblings in the hope that they had maybe heard from her, or like maybe, you know, she had gotten pissed off at him, so she drove back to Wisconsin and was staying with them. But unfortunately, when he got in touch with them, they were just as shocked and surprised as he said he was when he found out. So even though this was 1997 and people weren't nearly as trackable as they are now, as we mentioned, Bonnie was more trackable than most at the time. Not only did she leave the house with her cell phone that night, but she also had credit cards with her. And likewise, those were not used after the time she was last seen. Police interviewed friends and started searching along her route in wooded areas and in bodies of water. By the one-month mark, investigators seemed flummoxed. Lieutenant Dennis May told the Indianapolis Star, quote, "There have been no tips, sightings, or activity on her bank account or credit cards. There's no physical evidence of foul play, but we're not going to completely rule that out," end quote.
So this is 1 month.
1 month.
Into it.
Yeah. So from what it sounds like, the investigation, it kind of started maybe about 3 days after she went missing, kind of got into gear at the 1 week mark.
Okay.
and then proceeded from there. It was initially handled by the Marion County Sheriff's Department, but at some point, and I don't know exactly when, it was taken over by the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department.
Okay. So at this point, 1 month into it, do we know, have they cleared Rick? I would assume that the 10-year-old daughter alibied him.
I would assume that Gretchen, you know, did alibi him, although, you know, none of her statements about that were ever made public.
Sure.
About, you know, July 7th, like I said, is when it really started to kick off. And that's when police went to the men in her life. So they went to her husband and her boyfriend.
See, but how did they find out about the boyfriend?
So the boyfriend was with her that night.
Right. But so was another coworker.
Right. And by that time, Rick had found out that she was at that bar, and he could have only found that out from somebody who was there. So I don't know if it was Anita, you know, who he talked to, but he talked to somebody. So in any case, you know, whether they came forward or Rick was like, hey, my wife was with Anita that night, talk to her. Police ended up interviewing Anita and the boyfriend because they did find out that they were with her that night. And the boyfriend was like, yeah, we were sleeping together. Like, we were having an affair. So that's how police found out about everything. They apparently, you know, interviewed some other coworkers and things as well and other friends. But yeah, they, Anita and the boyfriend told them everything about what had happened that night and freely admitted to the relationship that was going on with Bonnie.
So assuming Rick didn't know up to that point, the police then probably informed him.
Yeah, if he didn't already know, he probably knew by about a week in. So when Rick initially reports his wife missing, you know, it's just a very basic, like, my wife didn't come home kind of situation, right? Then a couple of days later, she's still not home. The police actually start their investigation. So they come back to Rick and they say, okay, tell us more about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was around this time that Rick is like, okay, well, we were having marital problems. You know, I didn't tell you about it before because...
Well, I'm sure they didn't dig that deeply into it exactly. On the initial phone call anyway.
Well, yeah, I'm sure, you know, he didn't even talk to a detective that day, probably, right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Rick is, you know, admitting to the marital problems. The police know about the affair. If Rick didn't know already, he knows now. And the police decide to, of course, interview the boyfriend more. They talk to him, and we don't know much about him. Like, his name hasn't even been released. All we know is that he worked with Bonnie, and I'm pretty sure he lived in Broad Ripple. But in an article written in 2010, Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department missing persons detective Dan Kistner said that the boyfriend cooperated with the investigation and agreed to take a polygraph test, which he passed. Rick, however, was a different story. As I mentioned, there's been very little media coverage of Bonnie's case, but in both the Discovery.com article I was just talking about with Detective Kistner and a 2007 article in which IMPD Detective Catherine Byron was interviewed, it's clear that the police had a suspect in mind, and it's not the boyfriend.
Is it Rick?
Yeah. Detective Byron said in 2007 that no one had been ruled out as a suspect, but also talked about who could have done this, saying, quote, the person responsible for this was pretty involved. They had a plan, not only to hide Bonnie, but to hide her entire car, end quote.
Well, I mean, if we're talking murder here, like, he's the only one with motive.
Well, he's the only one with obvious motive.
Sure.
The boyfriend could have been, you're not leaving your husband, and now I'm mad. Like, you know, it could have been...
Right, but we know that she pressed for a divorce, they got into a fight, she went out, she was having an affair, he may have found out about it. He may have found out about the affair in the midst of the fight.
Mm-hmm.
We don't,
or even before that.
Or even before, right.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's way more obvious that he would have the motive if we're talking murder.
Right, which we are not necessarily talking, yeah. In 2010, Detective Kistner also gave more details about the early days in the investigation, including one disturbing discrepancy in Rick's story. Now, of course, the first major discrepancy was him telling police that, you know, they had a happy marriage and whatever. But we've already talked about this, that could be written off as embarrassment or wanting police to take her disappearance seriously and not just think that they got into a fight so she didn't want to come home, you know?
Right.
But a week after Bonnie's disappearance, detectives revisited the Schultz home. This time, they spoke with the children. When Rick gave a follow-up statement on July 7th, he went further into detail about what Bonnie had been wearing and what items she had with her when she was last seen, like when she left the house. And this interview was done over the phone. So when police went to the house to follow up, Rick was at work, but the kids were there. And it's pretty shady, honestly, that they talk to the kids.
Yeah, that's
like that at their house with no parents there.
That's not allowed.
Yeah, so anyway. Detective Kistner describes what happens next. Quote, after a short discussion, Gretchen mentioned items that her mother had with her when she left the residence on July 3rd. One of those items was a gift that Gretchen and Joshua had given to her, a gift she was always known to have in her possession. End quote. Now, police don't want to say exactly what the gift is, but they did say that day when they were at the house, they found the gift at the house. Kistner said, quote, the information received from the children conflicted with Richard's own statement to police in which he had listed the gift as property his wife had in her possession at the time she went missing. This led us to further question Richard's account that Bonnie had never returned home, end quote. Now, when confronted with this information, Rick said that he must have just been confused and had just assumed that he had had it with her. Like, maybe he didn't see that she had had it with her. He just assumed she did because she usually did. But hey, if it's at the house, then I guess I was wrong and she never had it in the first place.
Sure. I can see that.
Right. Absolutely. But detectives, on the other hand, believe that it shows that Bonnie did, in fact, arrive home after the bar and that something happened to her there. Rick, of course, vehemently denies this. And, you know, Gretchen, of course, didn't have anything to say that would support that theory. She didn't say, oh, yeah, no, mom came home at 4 a.m. or I heard yelling or, you know, anything like that.
She was home.
She was home. Yeah. Josh wasn't.
Assuming that she was asleep at, let's say, 4:35 a.m.
Yeah.
But she's in the house. So if something happened in the house, I would imagine it'd be pretty difficult for her to sleep through it.
Yeah, and she was 10 years old, you know. We're not talking like she wasn't a toddler, she wasn't a baby, like,
yeah.
She was a functional, like, aware human being, you know?
Right.
Now it's kind of a he said, she said type of situation, right? Like, police think that this is a break in the case, but they can't really prove anything with it because, you know, Gretchen's basically backing her father's story up, which is that he was there and the mom didn't come home.
It's also hard for us to say without knowing what the quote unquote item or the gift is. Like if it's a bracelet or something that easily could be taken off or forgotten to be put on,
mm-hmm.
then yeah, I can see where Rick would be like, oh, well, she always had it on her. I just assumed she had that on her.
Yeah.
Or is it something else that's potentially either harder to take off or something that she, it's hard to say, you know what I mean? Was it something as simple as she just forgot to put a necklace on?
It's just one of those things that it seems big deal, but it
seems pretty loose.
Yeah,
to me. But
yeah, it might not mean anything.
Right.
But it is interesting reading articles from around Bonnie's disappearance versus reading these articles that are like 10 plus years later, because they paint two very different pictures. In the first articles, Rick is treated like the grieving husband of a missing woman. He seems lost and confused, unsure if something terrible happened to his wife or if she simply decided to leave her family. But what strikes me about the interviews that Rick has given is that he is the only one really who's brought up the possibility of Bonnie leaving on her own. Everyone else who knows Bonnie says that she would never leave her children in a million years, like no matter what was going on in her life, in her marriage, and anything. But Rick brings up the possibility on more than one occasion over the years. In an article from July 30th, 1997, Rick doesn't give direct opinions on what he thinks happened to his wife that night. But when asked what he would do if she walked in the door, he said, quote, I would run up and give her a big hug and welcome her home. I would ask her if there was anything we could do and let her know we missed her. but why she left would be of secondary importance, end quote.
I don't know. Look, to me, that doesn't seem outrageous or indicative of guilt in any sense of the word. Like, they had a fight where she asked about, where she told him she wanted a divorce. She then goes out and never comes home again. You got to think that his mind is swirling around what actually happened. And I could see that being a logical conclusion.
If you take it like at face value and she literally is walking through the door, then one, you know that she's not dead.
Right.
Like, two, you know that she didn't accidentally die in some other way. Right. So that takes out a lot of the possibilities. So the most logical possibility would be like, oh, you did leave and now you're deciding to come home. So
now we need to talk about that.
Right. So like, if you just take it purely at face value, yes, you're right. That is a very normal answer to the question that was asked, which is, what would you do if your wife walked in the door right now?
Yeah.
But that's not the only time that he kind of talks like that. But just to put a point on, you know, who Bonnie was as a mother, Janice Sorensen, Bonnie's friend of nearly a decade, said in an August 3rd article that there is no way Bonnie would have decided to leave her kids. She told reporters, quote, she was very much a devoted wife and mother. It's just so odd. Police keep focusing on the fact that she may have left on her own, but it doesn't fit at all with Bonnie, end quote.
Ah, but you said police keep focusing.
Yeah, they did. And on they her
leaving
did.
On her own. So yes. It may not have been Rick even coming up with that initial thought. It may have been suggested by the detectives that were working the case.
Yeah. Or may have been both. I mean, either could've way. Been. But yes, police 100% did initially treat this as like a woman who just peaced out for a while.
Now, I do want to say I am not defending Rick. I'm not sitting here saying that there's no way that he could have done something.
Yeah.
I'm
I would agree, but I don't. And while you can take some of these things that have happened and put them in a nefarious light, they're not necessarily nefarious at all.
Right.
The articles published years later, though, are far more pointed. In 2007, Rick, who moved to Kalamazoo, Michigan with the kids in 2000, told Eyewitness News' Scott Swan, quote, I never thought she was the type that would get up and leave and run away. She wouldn't leave her kids behind. I don't think she had any thoughts of suicide or anything like that. I don't think the situation was anywhere near that desperate, end quote. He says later in the article, quote, if she left us and is happy, as difficult as that is for us, that's better for her. If something else has happened, obviously it's a bad thing for everybody, end quote.
I mean, I still don't hear it. Like, this is a guy that's like trying to figure out what happened to his wife, and this is 3 years later. He's still grieving over.
No, this was 10 years later.
Oh, 10 years later.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, that makes it even more. He still doesn't know.
Yeah.
Like, so, I mean.
And you know, again, we don't know the context of him giving this answer because, especially because he's bringing up, you know, I don't think she had thoughts of suicide. That was another theory that sure. The police had, that maybe she intentionally drove into a body of water. So the idea of her being in a body of water is one that has been around since the beginning. And the main reason for that is because the car has never been found.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, if you have a missing person and a missing car, there's a body of water involved.
So begs the question, what bodies of water are around their house?
So White's River is near their house. And there are several other retention ponds that are in the area that she was driving that night.
Is it safe to assume that at least the retention ponds were searched?
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that. I know I'm probably reading too much into it. I just didn't like the way that this last part sounded. If she left us and is happy, as difficult as that is for us, it's better for her. Something else has happened. Obviously, that's a bad thing for everybody. Like, obviously, that's a bad thing for everybody just, like, rubs me the wrong way. But that could just be a me thing. Detective Byron, on the other hand, stated very plainly that investigators believe that Bonnie did meet with foul play. So this is how this is the biggest way in which the case has changed in 10 years. And, you know, it makes sense because if she hadn't met with foul play, she wouldn't have 100% been found by then. But you know, it's probably a better chance that she would have been found by then.
Or at the very least, the car would have been found.
Exactly. That something, some clue, some trace, some something would have been found. But in 1997, police said, look, we don't have any evidence of foul play. We can't rule it out. But like, nothing here is pointing to that. 10 years later, they're like, yeah, it was definitely foul play. Detective Byron said, quote, I don't believe that Bonnie left her children and left her friends and left her job and took her car and hid it somewhere. I don't believe Bonnie has been living somewhere the last 10 years, end quote. And conventional wisdom would say that she's correct on that. I don't know what happened beyond that, but no, I think there's basically a zero chance that she took off and hid her car and never said anything to anybody in her life ever again. So by 2010, this is 27, this article that I was just talking about. So 3 years later, 2010, still no trace of either Bonnie or her car had been found. Detective Kistner's belief was that because the initial investigation focused too heavily on the theory that Bonnie left on her own accord, too much time had passed, and so they were unable to bring charges. From what it sounds like, kind of reading between the lines, and you don't have to read very far between the lines to think to see what he's saying here, but he basically thinks that if the initial investigators would have pushed Rick hard at the beginning and would have done like a thorough investigation with the idea that this was foul play, that they probably would have gotten the evidence they needed to bring charges against him. Of course, he doesn't come out and say that, but he does come pretty close. Now, back in 2008, he traveled to Michigan in hopes of interviewing the family again. And so this is 2010 where he's talking about this. He says, quote, I wanted to speak with Richard and Bonnie's children, who are now grown. Richard maintained that he knew nothing. He has made no attempts to locate his wife since her reported disappearance. Joshua still lives with Richard, who provides complete monetary support for his children. They have very limited association with any other family members. Both children refused to talk to me regarding their mother's disappearance. Gretchen stated that it would not change anything, end quote. So I think it's interesting what he's implying here, because he's basically implying that Josh, who's 25 now, still living with his dad and being supported by his dad along with Gretchen, who was 20, means that basically they're not going against him because of the money. Like, that's, is it, doesn't that sound like what he's saying, kind of?
Yeah, it sounds like what he's saying, but I disagree with him. Like, what is, really? Like, they're kids in their 20s.
Yeah, and you know? Then he's saying that they have limited association with any other family members, meaning, I'm assuming, Bonnie's family, because she had five siblings. So he's like, so basically what he's saying, he's isolating the children. He's supporting them. He's like keeping this hold on them,
yeah, but
to keep them on his side.
Sure, but A, we have no evidence of that. And B, what evidence we do have of anything is that in so many words, in different articles, they have basically said that Richard is the prime suspect, even though they can't bring charges mm-hmm. against him. So who knows what could have happened between Bonnie's family and them, meaning Richard and the kids, in the ensuing, this was what, 12, 13 years later?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have no idea. Maybe they don't have contact with them, with Bonnie's family, because Bonnie's family turned against them or against Rick, who is their dad. And if Gretchen was actually in the house that night, yes, she's 10 years old, but like we said before, like, she's a functional human being. Like, she probably wholeheartedly believes that nothing happened because she was there that night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we have no idea. So to make that kind of statement saying that, like, he's, you know, somehow isolating the kids and they're completely relying on him for money. I don't know. That seems kind of far-fetched to me without providing some sort of evidence to back this up.
I mean, I'll say yes and no. I get what you're saying, and I agree. On the other hand, I have watched hundreds of episodes of Dateline and have definitely seen that exact situation play out more than once. So it does happen.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but also not saying that this happened, but we have also experienced a case, Hoagie Hoagland,
mm-hmm.
where he did, in fact, just walk out on his family and disappear and start a whole new life. The difference between that in this case is he walked out on foot.
Yeah.
So we're missing a car here.
And he had done it before.
Sure.
You know, like he had a history of this behavior. She did not. Kistner went on to say, quote, "It is a very frustrating cold case. I've taken it very personally and have endured many sleepless nights thinking about it. It is my belief that Joshua and Gretchen would want to do anything and everything possible to locate their missing mother. I believe their failure to cooperate is because they know their mother is deceased and, quite possibly, who is responsible. Regardless, the perpetrator of this crime can rest assured that we will not give up." End quote.
But based on what? That's my problem. He's making these statements based on a feeling that he has because he's basically become obsessed with this case. He even admits to it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure he's a great detective. And there's a whole bunch that we don't know about this case.
Exactly. I mean, because all we know about, you know, the only clue, quote unquote, you know, that we have is that gift, right? That indicates that she may have made it home after the bar. But we don't have any actual evidence that she made it home after the bar. You take that with the fact that, again, rocky marriage, she was having an affair. Like, you have a lot of factors that do lead to wives getting murdered.
Sure.
By their husbands, you know, like, so there's a lot there. And it's like, if you look at history, it's like, okay, yeah, you see how this goes.
But there's no evidence of it.
Right, right. It's clear where investigators stand on the case, but does that mean they're correct? Detective Kistner said that Rick never searched for Bonnie, but I've already talked about how he said that he and Josh went and retraced her steps in the days after she went missing. He talks about these searches in both those July 30th and August 3rd newspaper articles that I talked about extensively at the beginning. But there's also an Indy Star article from November 2nd, 1997, titled "Man Scours Trail of Wife Who's Missing." That article talks about a small search with volunteers that Rick organized himself, a search that Marion County Sheriffs did not assist on because they said that they had already covered that ground and that the car was gone. That part is interesting because you really see that that was when Marion County was still on the case, and they 100% thought that she just took off, because like that was very much the tone of what the deputy was saying. Is like, look, we already looked there. The car's gone. Like, she took off, you know, she's gone. They were not at all treating this as a possible homicide. And I don't think anybody was until IMPD got involved. And I, like I said, I don't know exactly when that was, but it wasn't in the first several months. So in addition to this, like, search that he put together with the volunteers, he handed out 600 flyers, you know, in the area as well, and urged people in the article to keep talking about his wife, saying that he and his children weren't ready to give up hope.
I mean, so he has been searching for his wife.
Yes. And that is something that I do want to point out, because that's an objective fact. Like, what Kistner said, that he did not try to search for his wife, is objectively untrue.
Right.
Doesn't mean that he didn't kill her.
Sure.
But he did search for her. Recently, the group Chaos Divers has traveled to Indianapolis to perform water searches for Bonnie and her car. Whether you think Rick murdered Bonnie or not, most people believe that because her car was never found, that it's likely in a body of water, which we've talked about. Bonnie's route home, again, was not only near the White River, but close to a bunch of retention ponds. So when this was all happening back in 2023, Josh was extremely supportive of Chaos Divers' efforts and made a post on Facebook on March 23rd of that year. He said, quote, "Please share. I fucking love these people. Hope is a son of a bitch, one that I slowly come to grips with. These people have done so much for so many. My family feels lucky to have them as part of the team. They truly drive the search. Without them, Bonnie and the search for her may have been lost forever. Love the Chaos Divers." End quote. This is very much seeming like a son who believes that his mother is out there somewhere, and not necessarily that she was put there by his father, right? And you can see that he was very close to his father throughout his life and, you know, stayed that way and vehemently defended him against accusations. Just a few weeks prior to this recording, Josh's tune changed about Chaos Divers along with his wife. They both made scathing comments on one of Chaos Divers' Facebook posts. Are you familiar with Chaos Divers or Adventures with Purpose?
No.
Okay, so like we've talked about them about Adventures with Purpose before in the show, but basically what they are, these are two volunteer groups. They are divers and they use sonar and they volunteer their services basically to help with missing persons cases. So they'll go magnet fishing, they'll go diving, they'll put in sonar machines to usually to try to find cars that may have people in them. So that's what they were doing in Indianapolis. You know, they were looking for Bonnie's car in the river, in retention ponds, in several different bodies of water nearby. So, of course, so Josh is on board. He's like, this is awesome. He and his wife, Crystal, went out with them. So they did the search and actually did find two cars, but neither one belonged to Bonnie. So, you know, they left and they actually did make subsequent trips and did more searches. So everything's great. Everything's hunky-dory. The problem started, like I said, just a few weeks ago. I mean, back in May of 2024, when Chaos Divers had taken some of the video footage that they had shot of that 2023 trip and basically cut it into a couple different videos and reposted it on their Facebook page. The issue wasn't with the videos, it was with the captions. So in order to give context to these videos that were shot a year ago, the Chaos Divers, whoever, you know, runs their Facebook page, basically took excerpts from the 2007 article that I've been talking about, the 10-year anniversary one, to just give a basic overview of the case. But as we discussed, that article was very critical toward Rick and very clearly paints him as the main suspect. So Chaos Divers are just trying to give context. They're like not trying to do anything. So they post that they're like, you know, she went missing, blah, 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 blah. Josh goes on their video and is heated. And so is his wife, Crystal. He said, quote, maybe stop if y'all are just going down one idea. I've told y'all plenty of options. Look at the boyfriend from Broad Ripple. I have his address if any police are interested, end quote. The Chaos Divers admin apologized and said that they were just, you know, again, reposting the videos, like, and trying to give context to them. They also pointed out that on subsequent trips, they searched all of the waterways that the family suggested. So again, you know, Josh was like, hey, try this pond, try this over here, you know, whatever. And they're like, all right, cool. They did. They don't have a dog in this fight, you know? They were just trying to find her. And then Crystal hopped on. It was like all pissed about it, too. The Emma was like, hey, no, like this is from last year when you guys were with us and everything was cool. Like, remember that? How everybody was like happy with us and we were looking for Bonnie. And she was like, well, we didn't give you permission to talk about how we were there. We didn't give you permission to put us on social media. Meanwhile, like Josh made that post himself the year before that I had already talked about. So like it was just kind of, you know, a messy Facebook thing.
Yeah.
But it's not the first time that Josh has ripped into the investigation and detectives focus on his father. In another Facebook post that he himself posted 4 years ago, back in 2019, in which he posted his mother's missing poster, a commenter asked if police had ever investigated the possibility that Bonnie accidentally drove into a retention pond on her way home. Now, again, I don't know exactly what her route home in 1997 looked like. I've looked at the Google Maps of it, you know, currently and done Street View. I can't see a way in which she would have accidentally driven into a retention pond, but, you know, who knows? Maybe there are fewer trees. Maybe there are less obstacles. I'm not sure. It seems unlikely based on what I've seen, though. But in any case, Josh replied, quote, I can't be certain what they've done. Every time I reach out to them for information, they try and blame my father and make me feel bad for not having any information. Once, after I spoke with Detective Kistner, he stated to the Indy Star that we never spoke. Which, side note, I'm cutting off the quote here so we can talk about that. He's absolutely right. Kistner said that when he went to Kalamazoo in 2008, Josh and Gretchen refused to speak with him about his mother's case.
And we've already shown that Detective Kistner likes to say people in this family never did things when we have shown that they have.
Right. And so in terms of Rick searching, we have objective proof that he did. In terms of Josh saying that he did talk to Kitzner about his mother's case, that's a, you know,
that's his word against his. Sure.
Exactly. Yeah. We don't know. All right. So back to the post that he made. Needless to say, I don't trust them any further than I can throw them. I will be searching and trying to figure out this mystery without their help, end quote. He continued in another comment, quote, it's only too bad that they choose to look at one theory, one which they haven't been able to prove for 22 years now. I'm not a genius, but it would seem logical to possibly look at other avenues, perhaps even the one you just mentioned, end quote. Now, just as Rick stated in those early articles that he had searched for his wife, police also stated that they had looked down under other avenues, searching the woods and interviewing Bonnie's boyfriend and friends. The police investigation wasn't solely looking at Rick, and in fact, didn't start out looking at Rick at all. Their investigation and what they uncovered, of which, you know, we only know a small, small percentage of the information, but it seemingly led them to Rick. Whereas Josh's experience led him to anyone but his father being responsible. But that's not to say that Josh believes that his mother decided to leave him. In 2007, both he and Gretchen said that they did believe that their mother was murdered, just not by their father.
They didn't say who.
No. I mean, obviously, you know, Josh in that Facebook post from...
mentioned the boyfriend.
Yeah, said go look at the boyfriend, which in terms of suspects, like sure. That's really the only other one.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't think anybody really thinks that she just happened across a murderer randomly at 4 a.m.
Yeah. Who then was an expert at hiding her car.
Yeah. Nobody thinks that. Her kids don't believe that she got up and left. It seems to me like it would have been very difficult for her to accidentally, you know, drive into a retention pond. Nobody who knew her believes that she was suicidal. You know, I think that she could have purposely driven into a body of water and wouldn't have been found. But again, it just... nobody feels like that's a likely scenario based on what they know about her. Impossible? You know, of course not. What everybody does seem to agree on is that she did meet with foul play. There's just a huge divide between police and the family as to who's responsible.
I get that with what information there is, it's logical to trace it back to Rick, because in particular, because of motive.
Mm-hmm.
But...
with, and statistics.
Sure. Sure. But with what evidence we do have, there's no evidence that he did it.
Yeah.
Other than having motive, that's it. His daughter alibis him. Yes, she was asleep. But again, we've gone over, if something happened at the home, more than likely she would have woken up and heard it. There's no evidence that he actually did it. At least none that we know of.
Right. There are some cases that we've covered where there's an obvious suspect, and like, I'm baffled by why there hasn't been an arrest in the case. This one, you can kind of see why there hadn't been an arrest in the case, right?
Yeah.
But whether Rick Schultz was, as he and his children claimed, a grief-stricken husband and father, or someone who murdered his wife and hid her body, we won't hear any more from him. Richard Schultz passed away on September 18th, 2022, at the age of 71. You know, I do actually think that that's kind of important to this as well. If this was a situation in which, like, Gretchen had been covering for her father, let's say, or, you know, even Josh had been covering for his father, you know, he's dead now.
Right. And has been for, what, almost 2 years?
Yeah. Maybe that's the time that you say, okay, hey, listen, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, maybe there's... also the thing of, like, you don't want to really believe it. You don't really want to sully your father's name. You know, there could be a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to say anything, even though he is dead and nothing, you know, he can't go to jail, obviously, or anything like that. But again, also maybe, you know, they truly believe he didn't do it.
Right.
Chaos Divers, like I said, have done several searches, found several cars, but none was the 1990 dark blue Mercury Sable station wagon that Bonnie was driving the night she disappeared. There's still a chance that Bonnie and her car are in the murky depths of a body of water in Indianapolis, patiently waiting to be found. There's also a chance that whomever did harm Bonnie didn't act alone. Even though her disappearance was over 25 years ago, the answers to what happened to Bonnie Schultz are still out there, just waiting to be found. Bonnie Schultz has been missing from Indianapolis, Indiana since July 3, 1997. She was last seen driving her 1990 dark blue Mercury Sable station wagon with the license plate 99G9645. Bonnie is a white female with brown hair and brown eyes. She was last seen wearing a shirt with white, light blue, and dark blue stripes, navy blue pants, sandals, a herringbone necklace, a gold watch, and a wedding ring. Bonnie was approximately 5'5" and 160 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She was 45 when she went missing. She would be turning 73 next month. If you have information regarding the disappearance of Bonnie Schultz, please contact Detective Kistner with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department at 317-327-6160. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.